Welcome to Industry Insights, the EFM podcast presented by the European Film Market of the Berlinale. My name is AC Coppens and I am the founder of the Catalysts Agency. This podcast series shines a light on highly topical, trend-setting industry issues. It's designed as a compass for the film year ahead, helping professionals navigate the fast-changing creative landscape. Industry Insights is a year-round podcast co-funded by Creative Europe Media. Dive into a forward-looking conversation on the future of global film marketing. As audiences shift, data deepens, and new platforms reshape how stories travel, Marina Kosten, Adriana Trautmann, and Oliver Fegan show how disruption becomes opportunity. With sharp insights and case studies, the session highlights how experimental, test-driven marketing helps stories reach audiences more effectively. The conversation was recorded during this year's EFM. So, let's go. Marketing that works, turning change into a new advantage. This is what we're going to talk about today. And I'm very glad to have with me on stage really industry powerhouses who will be able to go into an in-depth exploration of global film marketing to explore together what are the latest trends, approaches and strategies for a successful content marketing. And we're going to follow up on the last year's session. So we're not going to do the same. That's the good news, right? We're going to go further. And I'm very glad to have still with us a second time, Marina Kosten, Senior Fellow at Center for the Digital Future at USC Annenberg and ex-20th Century Fox, which is great to have her back together with Adriana Trautmann. And I don't know if you remember, but Adriana launched her company basically on stage here last year, right? Before that, she was head of outside home country program at Amazon and previously VP of marketing for Paramount. So it's great to have them both again here with us. And they were also, and they are still, on the podcast. The podcast will be on the EFM platform for podcasting. And then we have a new one for this sequel, which is Oliver Fegan. It's good to refresh the series, right? He's a co-founder and CEO of Usheru, which is a marketing technology company behind film and live entertainment businesses to improve their marketing efficiencies, increase conversions. They work with 150 partners across 30 countries, and they are scaling, right? So it's great that you're working with Europe's leading film distributors, and it's great that we have the European and the US point of view here, because as we know, we can really learn together about new tactics, and this is what we want. I'm going to make to have you catch up because it is an advanced session today, right? So for those of you who were not here last year, I'm going to make a summary. So first of all, what you need to know from the 2025 insights. First, audience definition is the primary creative decision. Marketing doesn't start with tools or spend, but a precise understanding who is the film for. And then the clearer you are, the better you are. I'm repeating what you said last year, right? I mean, just make it, I'm trying to accelerate this, sorry. Then, international success follows proven local resonance. It means that stories travel best after they've been working culturally and emotionally in one market, and then they can scale along the audience signals. I'm glad to see that you are saying yes, this is great. So the global appeal is not designed upfront. Third, box office data is too late. So it means you need to go into the early indicators, trailer engagements, comments, completion rates of whatever questionnaires you want to do, qualitative audience reaction to something. This is what is allowing the marketers to adjust positioning before scaling. Fourth, I'm nearly done. There are only 5 points. Platforms win because they control the first party audience relationships. And they have access to this deterministic data and real time feedback. So that's why. And that's why you want this data, especially the producers and the distributors. And finally, marketing is not
any longer a launch event. It is a continuous process. I think this is really nothing new, but we really need to say this again and again. You need to test, you need to refine, you need to adapt before the release. And the successful campaigns are the ones which are treating marketing as an extension of storytelling, or actually even a part of storytelling, to be honest, right? So I'm really, really glad to start this conversation. And I would like to start with updates about audience shifts, because it always starts with an audience. Right? So how are these audience behaviors changing, specifically the younger audience? And I would like to start with you, Marina, with your research perspective. How has streaming maybe changed the way these younger audience are choosing their content to watch?
Change is ever present. Attention spans are shorter and shorter. The amount of content that gets put out seems to be infinitely more and more. So the attention spans are making it hard for people to catch and retain information about content, because everything is entertaining, everything is content. And so we're fighting for attention with things, not just with full content. It's TikToks of the world. It's human interaction. And the click-through rate right now is something around 3%. So we have very little time to grab somebody's attention before they're ready to go. The younger the people are, the harder it is for them to stick around for longer format. So we have to be cognizant of that change and that shift. Second screening is always very, as an adult in the room, is very disturbing, but it's a behavior that we all engage in. So we're challenged by all these forces that change the way that humans process information. It's not just about content, it's everything. And I think it's really important when you're making stuff and thinking about how you're marketing it to keep in mind that it's ever shorter, the volume is ever larger, and your jobs, from my perspective, your jobs is to make sure that people know when and where to find your content. I think I find myself lately saying things like, if you're putting out a poster, it's very important that your title, as well as where and the release date of what you're putting out, are just equal in space that they're occupying. Because if a person remembers where to go, they're likely to be recommended the content that they like, that's yours, versus remembering what it is and then having to find it. So I challenge you to think about helping people to remember what and where and when you're approaching marketing these days.
Totally. I'm so glad you're saying also, because I mean, when we say content, right? I mean, I see the rise of vertical micro dramas, webtoons, snackable stuff, right? And then we have the AI personalization drive. We have everything coming up. Everything becomes immersive, liquid, multiple. So how do you deal with that, right? So Adriana, you work with your consultancy also with filmmakers directly, and they're also trying to address the young audiences because they are the future, basically. So what do they most underestimate when you work with them? What do you notice?
I think one of the challenges is less underestimating and actually overestimating. I think, you know, we're all bombarded every day by all of the new things that are out there, whether that's AI or it's vertical dramas. Influencers aren't that new anymore, but it is certainly something that filmmakers are often thinking about. And we have a tendency to overestimate, I think, some of the importance of these new technologies. Yes, they are opportunities. Yes, there are potential tactics that we can use. But just because you cast an influencer, for example, does not mean that that influencer's 10 million people are going to show up to watch your movie. And so I think more than underestimating, we have a challenge with overestimating the importance of these things. You know, within our world, we talk a lot about vertical dramas. And yes, they are certainly growing. And yes, there is certainly an opportunity there. But it's not a mass audience. It's not for every genre. It's not for every audience yet. Mm. I think it's an important place to explore, to experiment, to be thinking about. But I think it's very easy to chase the latest shiny object, AI, right? We've got lots of different things that are out there competing, and we forget that, you know, traditional media still hits the majority of our audience, whether it's a billboard that's outside, or television, or even radio. I mean, we don't even talk about radio practically, but a huge percentage of people in the world still listen to traditional radio. And so, you know, you don't want to forget about the tried and true just because you're chasing these shiny objects. And I think that's part of our challenge, is that there's a lot of noise out there that we're trying to break through as marketers and as audiences.
Good point. Who heard radio this morning? Okay, well, okay, let's move on. Oliver. Based on Ushiru's data, how do young audiences, maybe in Europe, engage with independent film when you compare it to the US? Do you note specific differences in behavior and that impacts marketing decisions?
I suppose the audience are very similar. Like, there's a lot of similarities between young audiences in Europe and the US. Kids are busy, their attention spans are terrible everywhere. It's not a US thing, it's not a European thing. The biggest thing that we see from the data is paid advertising does not cut through with younger audiences versus older audiences. There needs to be a reason for them to leave social media, come through to the website. I was doing an analysis of TikTok traffic that comes through to distributors' websites that we manage. And it's the conversion rate for people going through to a theater or to a cinema or going to a streaming service is 0.1%. So someone's on TikTok, they're scrolling, that 0.3 is actually just like crazy. But they go, they see a film, they click on it. They're not even letting the showtimes load. They're literally just sort of getting to the page, seeing the film, and they're bouncing back out. So the challenge, I think, is to create original content that's going to engage young audiences. And this is also something that sort of brings into AI. Like when someone's looking for a film, they're probably asking, is this film worth watching? And so like ideas of original content could be 5 reasons why you're going to love this film. So something that AI can parse, but also something that actually when someone finds it, they go, okay, now I want to watch this. And generally, what we're seeing from traffic from AI or traffic, like organic traffic, you see a much higher conversion for young audiences. When they want to watch a film, they'll watch it in cinema. We see actually the big difference between young audiences and old audiences is young audiences have a much higher percentage that are watching the film that's on streaming services. But it's also probably because a lot of the younger content might be doing day and date release. So it's not just releasing in cinemas, it's releasing as well on home entertainment. But for content that skews a little bit older, the distributors are really it's literally just for theatrical. Mm. There's no, like very little engagement from streaming for an audience that skews a little bit older.
Thankfully. There is a debate that I've been observing through different festivals and different conferences, which is, there is a theory that young people are going back more massively to the cinemas. And the theaters. I would have the take to say, like, yes, we can see little trends, little films, little experiences, and etc. But actually, it's not massive enough. I mean, what would you say about the data, Oliver? Do you have any evidence saying, like, yes, younger people are going back to the cinemas? I mean, like, how is this to... Do you have any piece of evidence?
I would probably defer to Marina on this here, but the thing that we see is young audiences love, like kids love film. Like my kids, my oldest is 9, absolutely loves it. It's like any excuse to go to the cinema is great. 15, 16 year olds will go. There's anecdotal evidence what we hear about people are now dating and it's cool to go on a date to the cinema again.
Always has been.
Yeah, and there's schemes like Cineville in Europe where their actually average age is a lot younger. So there's people who are, 18 to 24 are actually going to the cinema and they're watching European content. Mm-hmm. And they're watching content that, people would traditionally say skews older. So, look, the market is there. It's product market fit. This is my sort of tech world. Product market fit. You need to have the right audience for the right film and reach out to them in the right channels to get them to engage.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of talk about the under 25s coming back to the cinema.
Yes.
Because they're so critical to the business. The younger segments always open films at the cinema. And if it opens well enough, it stays around long enough for the old people to come. As you said, they're not necessarily chasing information. So that has always been the case. Families and young people are critical to movie going because you kind of at that stage of life start your own personal relationship with movie going, which has been this last generation an issue because they've been pulling away from going to the cinema because the perception is that everything's available on Netflix most of the time. Even when it's not on Netflix, people believe that it's there. Good for them to brand that well. But there have been headlines recently that under 25s are returning to the cinema. A, they are for the right piece of content. They're not platforming. They're not going to the cinema for the sake of going to the cinema, which has been the case. They're going for the right content that's made for them, which is the importance, again, of making sure that they know when and where your content is
If it's for them, you just help them remember. That's my plea. Mm-hmm. The more important point is that the increase is off a small base behavior. So when you have a small base of people doing something and then there's an increase to that, it seems like it's a viable change. So yes, they are coming back for certain content if you make it for them and they remember, but they're not platforming back to the behavior of going to the movies, regardless of what it is, in the same way that the prior generations were. And that's something that we as an industry, I specifically am obsessed with that as an industry. I think we need to keep teaching young people to keep coming, no matter what it is, to discover new content that maybe is not made for them. But this habitual behavior is what's really, really important for the health of theatrical.
I would like to stay with you and dig a little bit more into that, because the shift from theatrical viewing, where we have these 20 minutes drive worth of most, to streaming behavior, where the first 5 to 10 minutes determine if they're going to watch or not. How did it change the way we have to position and market the film?
That's always a tough one, right? What do? Do you creatively tell a story about your story, or do you go in the first 3 seconds and try to grab their attention? Right? It's always a push and pull. So in a marketing world, when we are more removed from your content than you are as filmmakers and producers, we always want to hook people as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. Then the flip of it becomes, do you lose the creative passion for making that content? Or do you forego the control over the creative process when it comes to the content that markets your content? Or do you approach that also as an auteur, which is often the case? So I think there's this balance that needs to happen where both sides of the creative and distribution process come together with an understanding that you have very little time to grab people's attention very quickly. Mm-hmm. You will have, if you manage to hook them with something, you will likely have an opportunity to allow them to pull more content later on. But the idea is that any interaction that you have has to hook them very quickly and has to give them stuff to return back and to go search for more.
Adriana, given this change in this audience commitment, so to speak, how do you think should a filmmaker now rethink the marketing strategies when audiences decide much earlier if they stay or if they don't stay or if they come at all?
So I think one of the things to really understand is that you have to know where your movie is going to be shown to understand the audience behavior, to then understand how you're going to market to them. So it is very different to market on a streaming platform, for example, than to market for theatrical. In the case of theatrical, if you're trying to convince somebody to leave their home, to make an appointment, to go into the theater, you have a big job to do before they make that decision. So traditionally, we have awareness and interest and action as sort of different stages of your marketing campaign. You need them to be aware of your movie, then you need them to take interest in your movie, and finally take action. And in the case of theatrical, that action is quite significant, right? To block out a period of time, to make that appointment to go into the theater. So you have to work really hard to convince them each one of those stages. On streaming, they're often becoming aware of the movie, interested in the movie, and clicking on the movie all in one moment, right? You go on to Netflix, you see the storefront with a bunch of poster images.
Yeah.
That's when you become aware of it. Then you're like, oh, there's something in it, whether it's an actor or the genre that makes you interested, you click in that moment. So it's a very different approach. It's a very different timeline. And the amount of information that you're able to give is very different. And therefore, you have to think about it differently depending on where your audience is going to interact with your movie.
That's good. And it's changing fast, because I'm thinking now with AI-driven search, and I'm turning to you now, Oliver, probably we have new audience pathways, so to speak, to discover this content, maybe through ChatGPT or what. I don't want to make any advertising for it. Use Mistral. It's from France and it's from Europe and it is GDPR. But anyway, so does it change also the content strategy from generating assets up to two-phase marketing? Like, how is this AI stuff?
For us as a company, so we build websites for distributors, and I'm always going, like, are people going to go to websites in 5 years' time? What we're seeing right now is people are going to AI for everything. Like, I'm checking, like, for pretty much most things, I'm going to AI first, asking the question. And then what AI is doing is sourcing the information, and it's trying to say, okay, well, who are the credible sources for this content? And some AI friendly content. It's really ugly. It's like, it's not visual. Like, we want to build sexy websites that get people interested in the film. But you need to put the information in a way that can be parsed, if that makes sense. So like, the AI is looking for who is the credible source for the question that's been asked. And so like, search engine optimization, a lot of it's to do with video, a lot of it's to do with images, tagging this content correctly, and then allowing the search engine to say this is the credible source and sending someone. What the AI engines do is they basically will cite the relevant sources, and people then go to say, okay, let's find out more information on that. Mm-hmm. So I think producers, distributors, content creators need to think, why will someone want to watch my film? If I'm a distributor, like, why did I select this film? Like, make a short piece of content saying, we're in Berlin, we saw this film, the room were electric, it got a standing ovation, and we loved it. And I bought this film because I, you know, why did you personally enjoy it? Like, you're a person who's, we're moving from a creator's economy to a curator's economy. And I think a distributor is curating incredible content for their country. And while you're curating it, like, A24 are nailing it. People actually go, it's an A24 film, I'll get it. In Europe, we're seeing a lot of organizations are spending more time trying to become an A24. And it's a visual look, but it's also a content choice. So it's just sharing that. It's just sharing why you're selecting it. And then you're trying to get some original content about the film. So why the filmmakers made it, why the talent are doing it. So anything like that helps basically raise up the profile for people to find it. And then it's all about, in the week of the release, is just conversion. Mm-hmm. It's just get as many people who've shown interest in the 6 months before to come to your website, to find out the cinemas or streaming services playing it, and convert. And then just the people who come and go to a cinema's website, most people in e-commerce are not ready to buy. Like, they're looking, they go, this looks great, but then they forget, have to ask their wife or their granny or their friends, do they want to see it? And they don't buy the ticket there and then. Retarget those people. They like, we see it's roughly 15% of people we send to a cinema website and make a purchase. So like, 85% of people are not ready to buy. Don't focus on the person who watched 25% or more of the trailer. Focus on the people that actually just most likely abandon the cart. And if you retarget those people, mm-hmm. on a cost per click basis, the ones who bought the ticket, they're not going to interact with the ad. Yeah. The ones who forgot to buy it are like, oh yeah, I actually want to watch this film. And so it's just e-commerce. This is, you know, mm-hmm. making films is art, selling films is e-commerce. And it's just take people through that journey. Mm-hmm. And I totally agree with the awareness. We use that funnel in our analytics. It's, you know, awareness we always see is when someone comes to our partners' websites. But the interest for us is like, if someone watches the trailer, that's great. But it's, and someone searches in their city, that's a little bit better. But it's, yeah, the action is where you really need to target, because they're not making a transaction. They're taking an action.
Yes. It seems to me, even when you're speaking, that we don't only have a two-phase marketing with one phase of awareness and one phase of conversion, but we even have the retargeting phase, like, we're going to chase you, we're going to get you.
Yeah.
You know? So I see that the role of data is becoming really central into this, if I understand that right. So it's all about rapid testing, optimization, and reduce the risk that we lose these audiences, right? So Marina, from your experience across the studios and the platforms also, what kinds of data actually help marketers to test and optimize and reduce the risk?
This is a very loaded question. I love this question. Unfortunately, I'll start with the bad news. The bad news that there is very little data that connects ticket buyers to the marketing machines. People who purchase tickets purchase them from the exhibitors, and the exhibitors focus on their loyalty program members, right? Their efforts are spent on the people who are most likely to show back up, regardless of what the film is. When you market a movie, you want to market it to people who are available, right? If somebody had finished watching your trailer in whatever format you've served it to them, the fact that they finished watching it signifies deeper interest, right? If they are not interested, they will abandon it. So knowing who had seen something halfway or fully already identifies somebody for you. Unfortunately, this data is not owned by you or your distributors. It's owned by the social media platforms where you buy digital advertising. So forcing partnerships with, and they're not very good about sharing, but trying to learn, sadly, Twitter used to be, but don't use that data. It's not representative of anybody. Yeah. Unless you have an older man skewing action movie, maybe. those still make money in the movie theaters.
Yes. So
I think it's really important that you partner with your distributors as early as possible and partner with the exhibition as early as possible to try understanding on a first-party basis who the consumers are that are engaging with your content. I wish it was easier to do. I am definitely focused on it still, as I was last year, on making sure that there becomes this first-party data set that you can use. But I think generally as you're approaching data and research, I want you to think of it in three buckets. There is exploratory research, where you explore what's possible. You explore who is interested in your content and what about it is interesting. Then there is comparative research, where you compare what you have to other performers or other comps or things that you're co-releasing with or similar content. And then there is comparative research. And then there's confirmatory research, where you actually confirm whether what you have is working the way that you want for the consumers that you want. And sometimes you might find other audiences through that process. So I generally think about things in that framework. What's your goal for the data that you're seeking? Seeking data for the sake of having data is not a good exercise. But having a question in mind, having a hypothesis in mind that you're exploring and trying to figure out, are you trying to find something? Are you trying to compare it? Or are you trying to measure it and refine it? And I recommend doing all three if you have the luxury of doing, because that kind of gives you a more holistic view of what you're, if you're getting the right message to the right consumer.
Adriana, because you are really at the front with your clients there. And I mean, like, how can we make sure we don't fall into like complete over analysis and losing creative direction? I mean, how do we make sure that we are still aware of these early signals we were thinking about and talking about a little bit before, like the engagement and the interest and the reaction? I mean, how do we make that? We are between this mass and this art.
It's true. And I think marketing also has this mix of art and science to it. And I'm going to go back to what I said earlier about not overestimating the importance of certain things. Marina just mentioned Twitter. I mean, one of the things that filmmakers do again and again is they are swayed by a few comments, by a few fans, sometimes happy fans, sometimes angry fans. And they take that as a representative signal of the entire world hates our trailer, or the entire world wants to see, you know, something very specific about the movie. And those echo chambers are not necessarily reflective of your overall audience. And so it's really important to be doing actual research with a representative focus group or quantitative data that can give you real answers about what your audience truly wants, because otherwise it's very easy to be swayed by what you think is data and is really just signals within an echo chamber.
Right.
So that's a big challenge. One other thing that I wanted to go back to that we were talking about in terms of data and of retargeting people. I think we put a lot of emphasis on retargeting people who have watched our trailers, which is great. We absolutely need to drive them to action to buy tickets. What we often forget about too is then using the people who bought the tickets to help influence others after having gone. And I think that's just as important, if not more important. We talk about influencers within social media, but people who already bought a ticket for your film, already watched and enjoyed the film, to get them to recommend it to their social circle is your best form of marketing to keep that word of mouth going. And we often forget about them. Oh, we got them already. They bought their ticket. Over, done, moving on. Let's get somebody else. Those are the people who can really help you to get others to go along and watch the movie afterwards.
Oliver.
I think it's such an interesting point. We see a huge amount of user-shared content, like in Europe, WhatsApp's obviously massive. Yeah. Really interestingly, actually, there was for one faith-based title, there was like so many people sharing it on social media. They're obviously sharing it with their kids, trying to get them to watch faith-based content because the conversion rate was so low. But you see for younger titles, when they share on WhatsApp, you see a really high conversion. So people trust their friends. And it's really interesting. I've actually never thought they should definitely retarget the purchasers to say, like, share the love. It's a very simple way of getting people to advocate for your content. And one filmmaker we work with, he was doing a lot of grassroots outreach. And the one thing that he said, he had a film with zero marketing budget, had a huge really successful title. And I said, well, what was the success? And he goes, everyone who shared it, he always went back and said, thank you. Hmm. He said, thank you for people sharing. And what do they do the next day? They shared it again.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just like being human and saying thank you to people. And, you know, people who are enjoying it, can you retarget them and share them more about the film, the making of, you know, content like that, which will encourage the sharing and actually use the message, share the content, you know, share the love.
And I will add one more thing. Make it easy for them to share. Right. Again, this is the balance of control versus creative. Create content that once they buy tickets, if you go this way, that makes it as simple, because content needs to be shareable and share worthy. So this thank you is important, because if they're sharing something, it's a reflection of themselves. So you want to give them an ability to kind of be an opinion leader in a way, because it's reflective of who they are, but also make it super easy for them to just forward it or copy paste or whatever. Just like, there's a great, Google always talks about, you know, two clicks are too many. Give them a very simple way to almost mindlessly go and do it, rather than thinking through and having to find it and having to, you know, work to take that content and move it elsewhere. Just think about the seamlessness of the experience and make it instant and easy.
Mm. I think it's very typical to more behavioral e-commerce inspired approach, basically, right? Like, you like this, so you like that. This person loved this, so you're going to love that, right? So that's really great. So let's talk about the scaling. I think it's a good moment now to go from these, I mean, like, okay, we have some marketing events on the one hand, specific exhibition tactics and et cetera, but we have also the sustainable long-term audience behavior, so to speak. How can we move from this to that? And Marina, from the behavioral and research perspective, why is it actually so difficult to turn one-off marketing events into a repeat audience behavior and like make them even go more and enjoy more there?
Unfortunately, as I said, attention spans are very scarce and there's just an overwhelming amount of information and everything is content. Everything takes up time. I think the challenge generally has been is that we as an industry, and I mean everything entertainment, have taught people the immediacy of things. Everything will be available at your fingertips right now. And if it's not, it will be available somewhere in a very short period of time. So from the collapsing window strategy, unfortunately, the economics followed. If a piece of content is available on streaming first, it's the only time that it makes money. If it's available in theatrical, it has a runway of several years to keep monetizing it. For us, obviously, for the industry, it's better to find our audiences earlier in theatrical because it's a different relationship. If you look at the streaming behavior, things that are viewed most on those platforms are things that have been made elsewhere and have made it out theatrically and or on networks. I think that the challenge of and I refer to this as content behavior versus platforming behavior. Content is where you watch a piece of content no matter where it is. Platforming is when you sit down on your couch and you click on that Netflix tile and for 10 minutes you poke around dissatisfied about what you're finding, but you stick around because Netflix did a really good job of teaching you that anything you want will be there and it hasn't been for a very long time. So they did a really great job of changing the way that we behave by teaching us that they're there to entertain you. No matter what, you'll be entertained. Theatrical, as Adriana was saying, it's a heavier lift. It requires you to remember to proactively go and buy tickets, to advocate for others to join you. And unfortunately, with all these forces that I'm talking about, younger people are making different choices. So I think it, for us, as an industry that I still believe needs to be theatrical first in order to sustain, you just need the economics of it to keep making good content. So I think for us, we need to come together with the creative community and the businesses of and the marketing side of distribution to teach people to keep coming to the movies, regardless of what content is. So I think the shift needs to be for platforming, and it's possible to do. Uber taught us to Uber, even when we Lyft, where in cities like LA, we have never cabbed, and we do. So people can be taught using technology to do things the same way that streaming taught us not to. So I think there's a very necessary forces that need to come together for this industry to teach young people to choose to go to the cinema, regardless of what's there.
Would you like to add something on scaling?
Yeah, I mean, I would build on what Marino's saying. I think it's about building habit. For many years, for decades, in fact, there was a habit of movie going, and studios and distributors were responsible for marketing individual films. But really what sustained the industry was the fact that people were regularly going to the theater. It was part of, oh, Friday night, let's go out to a dinner and a movie, right? That was just ingrained in what we did. And we've broken that habit during COVID. And I think people underestimate the fact that exhibitors need to come together all together with studios to recreate that habit, because it wasn't necessary in the past, because we had the momentum and the inertia, they're not used to having to put in that amount of effort. And so most exhibitors are looking only at their loyalty base, right? Only speaking to a very select number of customers who are continuing to come. We need to rebuild that habit, because otherwise the lift is incredibly high and we're in this feast and famine moment, right? And the business can't live just by a couple of Marvel movies every year. It needs a steady stream of movies. There are plenty of movies, but not plenty of movies that can bring in mass audiences just on their own marketing budgets. It's way too expensive and way too heavy of a lift to do for every single movie. And so we need to work on that in order to scale. And it will lift everything up if we can recreate that movie going habit across the generations.
If we can. I mean, that will be another debate. Maybe we'll have it next year in the next sequel. Can we do that? But Oliver, to finish on scaling, I just wanted to ask you, do you see big differences between Europe and the US on this point?
I think the US is still relying more like on a mass marketing model. Mm. So like what we would see is the population of the US is probably four times bigger than Germany, but the US distributors spend an awful lot more money on advertising. Mm-hmm. It's probably 20x what the German partner is. So they would spend, you know, five times more to reach the audience. I think from a European perspective, especially with distributors who we work with, it's not a sustainable model. And we're really sort of pushing. We want this industry to be resilient. You know, you need to be, and to be resilient, you need to go direct to consumer. You need to own your audience. You need to know what they like, you know, what platforms they watch. Will they watch TVOD, SVOD? So we've built kind of community features, a little bit like Letterboxd, so people can track which films they've watched, they've rated. And what we're trying to do with this is to give our partners an audience that they own on the social media. If the social media is free, you are the product. And so that you're bringing the traffic to those social media platforms. But by owning the relationship with the consumers, you can reach out and say, hey, Ollie, I think you'd like this film because you liked that. And they can build personal relationships and build a real, like a meaningful community. And I think that's where I see the future for the European industry. The budgets are not the same. If you're not taking a Disney film, you know, you can't have the same expectations that you're going to have that size audience. If the odds are stacked against you, you need to play it differently. And it's own the audience, learn what they like. And then what we see actually in the US, which I think is interesting, is there's players like Paramount and Universal. What they're capturing first party data to build lookalike audiences. Yeah. So on the ad exchanges, they're finding out that Oliver Feigen likes this, this, and this. And they're saying, well, is there another 20 Oliver Feigens there that we can retarget? And they're going after them. And I think there's lessons to be learned from this. But at the end of the day, it's know who your audience are, what they like, and then be able to communicate with them. That's the future, I think, for European industry, because we don't have, like, there's some partners we deal with, their budget is 3,000 euros to promote a film in France. It's like, how are you going to get an audience for this? Mm. You know, it's very challenging.
Let's move to a real case studies. What about, I mean, we have Martin Supreme coming up, I don't know, next week, 2 weeks or something like that, or soon for sure. So do we have any insights about their marketing strategy? Can somebody say something about it? Who would like to?
Well, I'll start by saying that that is a movie that I think on paper probably had no audience. If you think about a ping pong player who's not a very likable person, who's just out for himself, right? You think about who is the natural audience for that. And you think, well, like three people maybe in the world. So I'm very impressed by what they've done. Timothée Chalamet makes that movie because it has become a Timothée Chalamet movie, and that is what people are showing up for. And he's probably one of the only movie stars at this point in time who not only can attract an audience, but he also is willing to go the extra mile to do all of the crazy stunts, to show up all over the world, wearing his orange suit and attracting attention and self-promoting in a way that created a movie that without him would not have ever become anywhere near the phenomenon that it has become in other countries where it's released to date. So I think, you know, power to them for having first thought to cast him and B, convinced him to do that and to go the extra mile. It's very impressive what they've accomplished.
I think it's helped tremendously. He said recently in a radio interview that it was totally his character. People are saying, like, I'm going to discover Timothée Chalamet in the films. Yeah. It's really fun.
I feel for me, it feels like they had a campaign that was a standalone entertainment experience, right? They were marketing a movie, but you were in these crazy things that all these stunts that they were doing. So you almost went on a journey to watch what their marketing was like versus the movie itself. And it was very expensive. So it's when you have talent who's willing to take on this, to do this kind of work. And we were lucky when we worked together sometimes to work with people, specifically Ryan Reynolds, I'll name, who was just a prolific marketer on top of being an amazingly talented human being. But when you have talent who's willing to do this, it almost becomes its own movie in itself. And you're lucky if you do.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I would like, maybe to move to a Netflix case, maybe something like the K-pop Demon Hunters.
I'm all about international content, finding its audience globally and expanding beyond what the original audience is. And I think what's really fascinating about K-pop Demon Hunters in particular is it's one of the only films that we've ever seen that started in streaming and then come back to a theatrical instead of the opposite way around, like Marina was saying. And I think it speaks to the audience behavior of younger audiences in particular, where, and I saw this in my niece who's 7 years old, and she discovered K-pop Demon Hunters at home and she learned all of the songs and watched it ad nauseum. And then she wanted to experience that with other people who also loved what she loved. And so, you know, for people of our age, going to the theater is usually about leaving the phone outside or turning it on silence, and you want pristine audio and you want a pristine, gigantic movie screen. What younger audiences are often looking for is community in theater. So they like watching it at home whenever they want to, but when they go to the theater, they want to watch it with other people who enjoy what they watch. And we saw this with Barbie, and we saw this with Minecraft, and we saw this with K-pop Demon Hunters. And it's very different. And there's a second screen component to that where they want to be filming themselves doing the chicken dance and singing along inside the movie theaters, right? And they want to share that not just with the people in the theater, but also with people in other theaters who are also experiencing this. And so it's more of a concert type of experience. It's a live interactive experience. And I think we're going to see more of these types of experiments coming, whether it's organic, as in the case of K-pop Demon Hunters, where I don't think Netflix saw that coming. Mm-hmm. But they learned to embrace it because they see the data. They see that people are watching it and they build off of that, right? And find the opportunities. Or people who are going to be, I think, experimenting with a theatrical format to find ways to make it inherently interactive and really tap into that new audience behavior that's manifesting. So I think the more that we can find ways to lean into that, the more we are going to bring back those younger audiences to theaters more regularly, which is great.
Great. I'm going to ask you the question next year, probably, like, okay, so what happened with these young audiences now? I would like to have a quick look to vertical drama economics also, if someone would like to pick that, this, I don't know, like, try before you buy model. Who would like to?
I can do it. Yeah, start and
please.
Give it up to you.
Go on, Laura.
Consumers, when it comes to going to the theaters, consumers' perspectives are that going to the movies is expensive. Right. It's not that the value of the ticket's not about a dollar amount, but because you think that everything's available for free at home, even when you pay a subscription fee, because you don't pay for it in the moment. So the perception has been about the value of the money. The same younger people will pay hundreds of dollars to go to concerts or festivals, but movies seem ubiquitous and the dollar value proposition has been off a little bit. What the vertical dramas have done, which I find very interesting, is this freemium or pay-per-view idea where you get a snack of something, short format, And if you like it, you can keep paying, right? They let you sample a little bit, and then you can keep paying for more snacks a little bit at a time. And oftentimes it ends up being quite expensive. You can get into like a $20 range for completing one of those mm-hmm. vertical dramas that is an equivalent of a movie that you would have seen. So this perception that people have about what it's worth seems to work when they have an ability to snack a little bit and then they get sucked into it. In video games, you know, it's freemiums that you pay for. So I think that it's interesting for me to see that we are playing with this idea, because it's, again, the value is there if they feel like they get it, they get sucked into it enough. It works for specific segments and specific genres thus far. I'm really looking forward to see what else evolves out of it. But I think it's great that consumers are willing to pay.
I would add to that, sorry, just in terms of risk, I think is where this inherently comes into play, is if you're going to buy a movie ticket, you are risking potentially 2 hours of going to a movie that you may not like, right? This is from an audience behavior perspective. But you have to commit and pay the money up front and commit your time up front. For streaming, there's a very low risk because you press play, and if after 5 minutes you don't like it, you X out of it and you find something else to watch. And in the case of the vertical drama, there's also zero risk because you start, you watch 1 minute for free. If you like it, then you watch another minute for free. And then by the time you're hooked, there's no risk. You already know that you're enjoying that content. And every minute you're reinforcing whether or not you're still interested. So I think it's just a reflection of our risk aversion in terms of being entertained and that opportunity cost versus watching TikTok or Instagram or YouTube or any of our many other options of how to be entertained today.
It's really good, really good. We wrote like a complete report on risk taking in cinema, so it resonates completely. Anyway, I wanted to ask you too, maybe Oli, do you have a case study you would like to bring? Like, I don't know, maybe a US, Europe, a different thing, or would you like to?
A couple, actually. Well, I think the general point here is, which I think is so interesting, what the guys are saying. You really, like, you've got one night out probably a month, you know, or a week, depending on your economic situation. What I think film distributors and filmmakers need to do is really make it clear. They need to get people emotionally invested in the story. So it's not just seeing the trailer. It's like, why should I watch this? Is there a movement? Like my son Chicken Jockey, like he was going to go and watch that in the cinema because he saw so many memes of this. And I think that was definitely manufactured. There's some interesting European partners we work with, like Studio Canal. They're doing some really interesting stuff for a release, Woodwalkers, which is a German, I suppose, piece of content, like I said, film series. And what they're trying to do is to build like sustainable communities between the releases. So they've built like WhatsApp community groups where people can talk about it. And I know the second film's currently in cinemas, and I haven't looked since the first film came out, but they had 60,000 people in a German-only language community, which I'm sure it's probably doubled by now. But over the 2 years between the two films, people are talking about it, what's going to happen next, getting to know the characters. And we see other platforms like Discord, which are quite interesting from a gaming perspective, but also coming into anime, where the narrative is about not just selling people a product, like go and see this film, but trying to build that relationship. And I think that's the really exciting part. There's the game is changing. The monetization strategies can change. And it is more challenging sometimes for European content because there's not a single market. You know, you're distributing only in Germany, and Germany is a huge market. If you're distributing from my country, Ireland, it's tiny. And you may have success for your film in your local market, but to actually sell an Irish film in Latvia or in, you know, in Germany is a challenge. And I think there's benefits from a US perspective for that. For me, I think it's what we see is where films succeed in their own market in Europe, they do have a better chance of success. But for independent content, you need to get that initial audience to go on the Friday night, that first weekend, so the word of mouth can happen. Because Europe creates incredible content, and there's so many good films. But when you ask people, have they heard of this film? They go, I saw this great film. Have you watched it? They've never heard of it. And that's the problem. People just don't hear about it because they can't market the same way as the US studio system can do, or Neon or A24. So there's challenges and opportunities. And I think the only way to basically circumnavigate the challenges is by really focusing on building a long-term audience that you can communicate with between releases. And we've one partner that works in the event cinema industry, and they get 25% of their conversions across all their releases from email marketing. So they know who their audience are, and it's sometimes it's musicals, so they have their musical audience, and they say, this musical is coming. It skews slightly older, so the older audiences actually are, you know, they read their email, and they think this is important. Like I was talking earlier, we're saying it's like my dad gets emails to rate a service 1 out of 10. He's like, "Will you come to my house?" Because this person's emailed me twice. They go, "Dad, it's an automated email," but they convert. They convert, and this is about the audience.
Email is really something which is underestimated, I believe. Yeah, absolutely.
And Google ads, you know, people are just doing so, like, people know Facebook ads. I see sometimes for young audiences or partners, and they're doing Facebook ads for young audiences, and I'm going, what are you doing? What are you doing?
By Twitter.
Yeah. And it's because they know how to put the ads. It's really simple to put the ads up. They've done it for the last 15 years. Everyone was on Facebook. The audiences have left. But it's like, I know how to do it. So I'm sort of fulfilling my duty to do ads. But then my film doesn't succeed and it doesn't get the word of mouth and it doesn't, you know, scale. What did I do wrong?
Yes. Well, here at the European Film Market, I hope that producers got a good input here on this platform, here on this stage, to make their film be seen and heard before people are actually going to the cinemas and later also on the platforms.
A warm thank you to our wonderful speakers, Marina Kosten, Adriana Trotman, and Oliver Fegan, for sharing their insights on marketing that works. And of course, thank you, dear listeners, for joining us and being part of this journey. And that's all for today's episode. This season of Industry Insights is co-funded by Creative Europe Media. Be sure to subscribe and help spread the word. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts and also on the European Film Market website at www.efm-berlinale.com. We look forward to welcoming you to future episodes of Industry Insights. Thank you for listening and goodbye.